Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That magnificent playing is by the great Barry Tuckwell. This is the opening of the Richard Strauss Horn Concerto No. 2 in E-flat major and a recording with the London Symphony Orchestra in István Kertész. Barry Tuckwell had an incredible career as a French horn soloist. Over the course of several decades, he made over 50 recordings. His final performance as a French horn soloist was in 1997. He was also a much admired conductor. Australian Barry Tuckwell died on the 16th of January, 2020, at the age of 88. In honor of his great career and in memory of this superb musician, I want to replay for you a portion, it's all that survives, of the earliest interview I remember doing on the morning show way back in 1990. It was a special year for the Kenosha Symphony, their 50th anniversary season. And at that point in time, LeBlanc Corporation was still in business here in Kenosha making music instruments. And Barry Tuckwell was one of their featured artists. And it was through the generosity of the LeBlanc Corporation that Barry Tuckwell was brought to Kenosha to appear with the Kenosha Symphony as a soloist. And I had the tremendous thrill of interviewing Barry Tuckwell in our studios on that occasion. This was years before I became a regular participant in the morning show, so I was very green as an interviewer and scared to death of speaking with somebody with the renown of Barry Tuckwell. Here is a portion of our conversation. It is all that survives, but I cherish the memory of having encountered this great musician. One of my questions for Barry Tuckwell was essentially why, when one goes to typical orchestra concerts and band concerts, you're likely to hear the most sort of blatant and serious missteps, musical mistakes, sort of broken, cracked tones and so on from the French horns. Is there something about the French horn itself that makes it an especially difficult instrument to play? And here is his answer.
I think it's difficult to evaluate difficulties of instruments because every instrument is difficult to play at its extreme. However, the horn is not a very efficient instrument. And by that I mean that compared with the other brass instruments, it's perhaps the least well designed. Mm-hmm. And when I say designed, I mean traditionally the horn has a long tapered tube, whereas say a trombone has slightly shorter, but not tapered tube. It's more cylindrical. Now, the horn makes a beautiful sound. Well, it's, the instrument is capable of making a beautiful sound in the hands of a good player. But it doesn't respond terribly well. It's sort of inefficient. It's what we call restricted. It's a heavy-blowing instrument, whereas a cornet or a trombone are free-blowing. Now, if you improve a horn so that it's more efficient, you change the contour of the tube, and you change the sign of the mouthpiece, and you'll end up with something approximating a trombone, which is a very efficient instrument, but it makes a different sound. Mm. It'll then sound like a trombone. So to retain this rather, it's called nostalgic sound. It's a mystical word, because how can you be nostalgic for something that you've never heard before? But it does make you sort of reflect. And it's a very romantic-sounding instrument. To retain that sound, you have to have what is basically not terribly efficient taper of tubing.
Hmm. You have said that the French horn chose you rather than the other way around. Can you explain what you mean by that? How did that happen?
I grew up in a musical family. My father was a professional musician, and my sister played the violin. And I tried to play the piano and the organ and the violin, but without any great success. And a friend of my sister's, a group of musicians who were talking about me, and I think they were saying, well, what are we going to do about Barry? You know, he's 13 and he's musical, he must be able to play something. And a friend said, look, I've got a spare French horn, I'll give him some lessons and he can borrow the instrument. That's how I started. I didn't choose it.
Talking about the inefficiency of the horn itself, just that what is inherent there, was it discouraging for you at first? Did you find it difficult, or did you find that it was a good match?
I thought it was easy. I thought, this is a piece of cake. This is a really wonderful instrument. Only one note at a time, and slow. I mean, you didn't have to play quick passages like piano or violin. As time went on, I found that there were other problems. In fact, it is a difficult instrument. But in terms of reading music and that sort of thing, I thought it was a cinch. I liked it.
So you were made for each other in some respect. You were principal horn with the London Symphony, I think it's something like 13 years, quite a tenure there. As you look back, what are some of the special pleasures that remain with you?
It's difficult to select, because while I was there, we played for the best conductors, and we had as guests the greatest soloists, and I felt that I was learning something, whatever we were doing. But we certainly played for some rather fine conductors. We did a lot with Scholte, of course. while he was, at that time, he was the music director in Frankfurt. We did a great deal with Leopold Stokowski, which I found an extraordinary experience. George Zell, Eugene Normandy, you name it. I mean, historic figures, and now we played with some of the young kid conductors, the young whiz kids. One of them, music director of the New York Philharmonic now, Zubin Mehta, Seiji Ozawa, Boston, and Abado, who was really young, now he's conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. So one saw these people on their way up, which was also quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you relinquished that post when so many solo opportunities were coming your way, and there are just so many hours in the day. But I imagine that was a difficult decision to make.
No, it was very easy, because I didn't intend to give up orchestral playing as such. My intention was to be free from the orchestra so that I could give my first preference to the solo engagements without obviously having to give precedence to the orchestra. And I knew that there was more than enough freelance work in London for me to do as a jobbing horn player. I mean, I could play in the studios, film music and that sort of thing. So I knew I had that as a backup, but in fact it didn't work out that way. I didn't have time to do any of that, so I did in fact give up actively playing with large groups, and I haven't played in an orchestra since.
So you weren't particularly frightened at the prospect of leaving the security, shall we say, of an established institution? Mm. Or?
No, I saw this as a new adventure.
Something that's relatively new to your career, I think, although maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is your ascension to the podium as an orchestral conductor. What is the story behind the beginning of that venture?
Well, that goes back nearly 20 years, although I was conducting students before then. There was a festival in London called the South Bank Festival, a summer festival, and Andre Previn was the artistic director of it at the time, and I was involved in it in many ways, soloist, chamber music. In fact, that's when we recorded the Schubert Octet, because the Cleveland Quartet was in residence, and so was my quintet, and all these things were moved together. And Andre said to me in the planning stage, look, that concert, I've got a very big day the next day, and there's only one piece that needs a conductor. Would you do it? So I hesitated for perhaps 2 to 3 seconds, thinking, this is the only time I'll be asked this question. So I said yes. And it went from there.
Have there been surprises as you've delved into conducting, bad or good, as far as things you maybe didn't expect?
Well, let me say this, that the first thing I noticed was that, well, of course, I knew that the conductor does make a sound, and that's fairly obvious, but the difference I noticed first was that when you're playing an instrument, you are arguably in control of what you're doing, so that if you want to play quicker, you play quicker. If you want to play louder, you play louder. It's instantaneous. With conducting, you are interpreting your music through other people, and you have to get their attention. And you can change direction. You can start beating faster. And it doesn't make any difference. It's a completely... In fact, I felt frustrated. I thought, this is awful. I don't like this because I don't have any control. Then, I worked it out that you have to... It's a completely different thing. You have to persuade people to do things. I mean, there was a time when the conductor was a tyrant and the players didn't follow his every whim. They got fired, but you're not allowed to do that anymore. And even then, you can't change the direction of an orchestra. You can't. It's like an oil tanker. It takes them, 12 miles or something to stop. And to change direction is a major operation. Well, an orchestra's like that. It's got a momentum of its own. And it's not like a sports car where you can suddenly change direction. No. It takes a lot of persuasion and thought and premeditation, although things in the end have to sound spontaneous. A lot of premeditation goes into any craft which contributes to an art. I mean, playing an instrument, you have to know your craft. You have to know how to get a certain sound, how to change things. If you don't know your craft, you can't serve the music because you don't get the results you want. Mm-hmm. The same goes with an orchestra and conducting an orchestra. It requires a lot of craft which may not be perceptible to the onlooker immediately. And they look at the orchestra and they see nobody is apparently watching the conductor. Well, they're not, in a sense, because you shouldn't have to watch. If you're a good musician, you play instinctively by what you hear. But at the same time, you have to be aware of what the conductor's doing, because orchestra's a large ensemble, and acoustically you're not always able to hear accurately what somebody's doing on the other side of the stage. Maybe just that it's too loud. There's so much noise going around that you can't hear. So you have to have somebody who is controlling things. And so a conductor at a concert is really there for emergencies, controlling balance, moving things this way, adjusting things. Things left to its own volition, an orchestra will probably fall apart because of people not being able to hear each other. One side will get quicker, another side will get slower, until in fact the boat has taken on so much water that it sinks. Mm. So a conductor is essential and is being observed, although it may not be immediately noticeable to the public.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you learned most of what you know about conducting in your years as an orchestra player, watching and learning?
I think it's an invaluable basis for conducting, to have played in an orchestra. For one thing, you understand the problems of making a sound. That's why I like to continue playing, not just to conduct, because for me it keeps me in touch with reality. It's very easy to get onto that podium and forget that it's not only difficult, but quite often nerve-wracking, playing an instrument, making a sound, having to play in tune, a difficult passage and matching it to somebody else, and speed and tempo, perhaps at a speed that you don't naturally want to play. And so I think all these things contribute to being an all-round musician. And that's what I try to be, a musician, above all else. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, in addition to being a musician, you have to be sort of a juggler as far as all of these different activities that you need to somehow keep in balance. Is that sometimes a little more difficult than you wish it to be? Do you ever wish for a simpler career with one venture at a time?
Frequently. I think, why am I doing this? Because it's as I said, it's a strain, and it's difficult. If you're not feeling particularly well, having to play particularly a brass instrument, which is physically demanding, you think, I really just don't want to be bothered to do this. But then, of course, the music takes over, and then you enjoy it. And that's, for me, that's what it's all about. Sometimes traveling, it can be very frustrating, going to a place that you don't know, and you find it's awful, the hotel's not any good, and there's a lousy restaurant, and you go to this third-rate hall, and there's second-rate orchestra with a tenth-rate conductor, and you think, what am I doing in this place? But then when it comes to the performance, I always blot all that out, and all I'm doing is making music as best I can. Hmm. And I won't listen to the things I don't want to hear.
Sounds like a wise decision. We actually haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about the French horn, as a matter of fact. Tell me a little about who you learned the French horn from, the teachers and maybe players also that you deeply admired.
When I started the horn, latter part of the Second World War in Australia, there really were no recordings, no CDs, they weren't invented. Long playing records hadn't been invented, and there were very few solo recordings available of horn players. In fact, I don't think there were any. But what was available, which I used to hear on the radio, were an immense number of recordings from the swing era, and in particular recordings of Tommy Dorsey. And I was very taken by how he could play lyrically on a brass instrument. And I used to play along with his records. And I feel I learned a lot about phrasing and breath control from him, although he wasn't aware that he was giving me lessons. He was. And since then I've found out, of course, that Frank Sinatra, who was a vocalist with Dorsey, felt exactly the same. He used to sit there when the band was playing and the vocalist wasn't singing and watch Tommy Dorsey play and try and work out how he breathed and how he phrased. And I was talking to Nelson Riddle about this same thing too, and everybody has had this same message from Dorsey: phrasing. That's the one thing. So really my first inspiration on the horn was Tommy Dorsey, but he played the trombone.
Speaking of craftsmanship, that was such a nice picture, and it brings to mind the horn, which is being produced, I think, even as we speak, by Holton, distributed by the LeBlanc Corporation, located in Kenosha, that bears your name. Is this a horn that you have helped to design? What has been your part of it?
I first really became involved with Holton. Oh, must have been about 20 years ago at a horn workshop in Tallahassee, Florida, where I met Ted Kexel, who was a very persuasive man, and said, you should play one of our horns. I said, well, I'm not sure that, you know, the ones, models you make are really suitable for what I do. And he said, well, next year. No, later this year, he said, we are producing one. It's called the H180 Farkas model. And I came to Elkhorn and selected my Farkas model H180 French horn, which I played for many, 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 many years. And a few years ago, it was suggested that perhaps we should develop a Tuckwell model horn. And that's how it happened. And so it, in a sense, is a collaboration between my feelings of how a horn should be made and the expertise and design of the Holton and the LeBlanc Corporation. And it's been very, very rewarding and very interesting to be part of an instrument that is sort of you. Because a lot goes into building a horn. A lot of people think it's just a straight plumbing job of soldering a few bits of metal together, but much more to it than that. There's so much that happens with metal. Once you start bending it and turning it and spinning it, it has a grain to it, like wood does. And every time you do anything to it, like denting it, which is bad, that grain size changes irrevocably. So in the manufacturing process, you have to have good virgin brass to begin with, which is a mixture of several metals. And every time you spin it and hit it and tap it and bend it, it changes it, and you have to know what you're doing. So that sort of craft side of it is fascinating, and the assembling and of it, and making the valves and all these intricate parts. It's not an instrument that you can mass produce. It's very labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of, I don't know, forget how many hundreds of parts. It takes a lot of time to stick them all together and to make sure they're correctly aligned and the tapers are right and that sort of thing. It's a fascinating business. You go into a workshop where a violin is made, and it's all sort of quiet and lovely smell of glue and wood. You go into the beginning stages of a French horn, and it's acids and chemicals and, you know, it's a metal and everything, and then gradually this is transformed into this beautiful instrument which we see. But every one of those people is involved in producing musical instruments, and I hope they are as rewarded by the instruments as we, the players, are. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've got to know so many of the people in the factories in Elkhorn, and it's very nice to meet them, say hello, and it gives them, I hope, a sense of identification with the musical instruments which they're creating.
I know that the musicians of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra are thrilled at the prospect of having you as an honored guest soloist a little bit later this season, but I imagine it's not the sort of symphony that you play with every day. What do you expect from the experience?
Well, however gratifying and rewarding it is to play with the great symphony orchestras of the world and the great concert halls, Carnegie Hall, or play with the Philadelphia Orchestra, I mean, yes, it's wonderful to do that. But what I enjoy about playing in a smaller community is that there's a sense of contact with the people in the audience. I've experienced playing in places where you're tripping over the customers, so to speak. They're all over the place. It's a rotten hall. The acoustics are dreadful, and there are people all around you. But yet you feel this is wonderful. They're all there as part of it, and they really want to be there. And it's something that you cannot get if you're playing in the Hollywood Bowl. There's no way, you know, whatever it is, you know, 15,000 people there. You can't even see them. So you're playing in a void. And that's a different way of making music. But in the end, I enjoy making music where I think somebody going to listen to it or be part of the performance, because it's a two-way thing. It's not just one person performing. The audience is also part of that, almost a religious experience, because it's a one-off occasion. It's the one time of that one performance. No repeating, because the next performance will be different. That's the difference between a performance and a recording. Every time you play the recording, it's going to be the same. I have loads of recordings, and I very rarely play them for that sort of enjoyment, because I know what's going to happen. And the joy to me of going to a live performance is that I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be special, and I'm, as a listener, I'm going to be part of that. And that's something that you experience in a smaller community, that feeling of the people knowing they're coming to a special sort of occasion, something that is unique.
Well, it certainly is that, to welcome you to this community. We look forward to that evening of music making with the Kenosha Symphony and wish you the very best as you continue with your illustrious career in all of these various avenues. We wish you the very best and thank you for your time today.
French horn virtuoso Barry Tuckwell visited WGTD back in 1990, just before playing with the Kenosha Symphony for their 50th anniversary season. He died on January 16, 2020, at the age of 88. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Anyone who is a musician or a music teacher and who wonders about the miracle of making music, and anyone who cares about educating our young people and the most effective ways to do that, is sure to find all kinds of things to enjoy in a remarkable new book called Strings Attached: One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. This is the story of an extraordinary music teacher, a public music teacher by the name of Jerry Kupchinski, known affectionately as Mr. K, born in Ukraine, and he came to America with a mission to make the young people he worked with the finest musicians they could possibly be, with unwavering relentlessness and devotion to that task. This book about him has been co-written by two of his students, one of them his daughter, Melanie Kupchinski, a brilliantly talented violinist who plays with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The other author to whom I'm going to be speaking today is Joanne Lippman, who is a highly regarded journalist and has done all kinds of award-winning work for Portfolio, The Wall Street Journal, and she has supervised Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage at the Wall Street Journal. She has been a frequent commentator on public radio, on CNN. Her work has appeared in Newsweek, New York Times, and she has done a wonderful job of helping to bring to life this memorable figure in her own life, her own string teacher, Jerry Kupchinski. Again, this book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And Joanne Lippman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And I love what's said in the foreword of the book, that if Mr. K wasn't a real-life character, somebody would have had to invent him. And he does certainly resonate on the page as almost a figure out of a novel or a figure out of some great film, but instead he was a flesh-and-blood man who influenced so many lives so powerfully, including your own. One of the things that's what's interesting about your perspective versus that of his daughter Melanie is that she has gone on to use music in her professional life and was a brilliant prodigy right from the start. Your own relationship to music, discovery of your own talents, was a much more, shall we say, checkered experience. And of course, you've gone on to a professional life that really hasn't included music to any meaningful full degree. Just talk for a moment about the interesting contrast between you and your co-author and what that felt like as you penned this book together.
Right, that's right. So Strings Attached, as you said, it tells the story of this one remarkable music teacher who changed the lives of thousands of students, whether they became musicians or whether they went into other fields. And in that sense, in the larger sense, it really is about the mentors that we all have in our own lives. And I do think that, you know, one of the reasons Strings Attached is resonating with people is because, I mean, he has a remarkable story. He was larger than life and had actually quite a tragic personal story. And the fact that he was able to translate that into a legacy of such joy for his students is quite remarkable. But I think a large reason it's resonating with people is because it reminds them of that person in their own life and how, you know, a great music teacher, like a great soccer coach or a great English professor, teaches you things that go so far beyond the classroom. And so for Melanie and myself, as you said, Melanie is a violinist with Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I went on to become a journalist. Yet we found that the lessons that he taught us, things like perseverance and resilience and self-confidence, are all of these qualities that translate no matter what sphere of life you're in. But doing it, as you mentioned, writing the book together was so rewarding, because what we do is we tell his story from two points of view. So we are the same age, Melanie and I. We grew up together. She was a child prodigy violinist, as was her younger sister, Stephanie. And I was just an ordinary student. But Mr. K, when I began taking viola lessons, put us all together in a quartet, and we performed together for our entire childhoods. And so that was like a wonderful experience playing together, and we really learned about the passion, we developed a passion for music and really learned about the bonds that music creates among people who play it together. And the wonderful thing about writing the book was, so Melanie and I had gone our separate ways after high school and really lost touch with each other, and it wasn't until her father's memorial service, which we write about in the book, that we reconnected and started trading these stories about her dad, and realized that, you know, from my point of view, from the whiny student point of view, I saw the tough teacher not understanding or appreciating the difficulties and challenges and tragedies in his own life. And so the way we structure the book is with these two voices, where I tell the kind of outside whiny student perspective, and she tells you exactly the same thing that's going on inside his life, where there's, at the same moment, the kind of tragedies and challenges that he is confronting. Writing the book together felt, as it did when we were children, it felt like a duet, and we hope that it reads that way. It was like trading melody and harmony back and forth between each other. It was quite a remarkable experience.
Very nicely put. And yes, I love the fact that we have two different voices that are in harmony with each other, although by no means are they the same voice, nor are they the same perspective. Far from it. There's a humorous photograph of you as a youngster with your two talented sisters. And this is at a point in time when there does not seem to be at this point much talent in you. Tell our listeners about that little photograph.
Right. So there's this wonderful photo, and it's because we talk about Melanie, who had a violin put into her hands at the age of 4, and she talks about that. And Melanie was a brilliantly talented violinist. But in Mr. K's world, talent was beside the point. He did not think there was anything, there was no such thing as an untalented child, simply a child who could work harder and focus and be more disciplined. And so when I became his student at the age of 10, I had flamed out. And the photo you're referring to just shows you kind of my lack of talent. It's a photo of myself with my two older sisters, one with her violin. She became a music teacher, actually, a brilliant musician. My middle sister, who's sitting at the piano, who was a brilliant pianist and flute player. And then there's me, where in a ballerina pose, even though I didn't take ballet, because my dad's taking the picture, and, like, it was hopeless. I had no talent. He's like, put your hands over your head so it looks like you're doing something.
Well, eventually, of course, you are united with the viola and with Mr. Kopczynski, and the rest is history in many respects. One of the things that one of you says about I think it's you at one point in remarking about his approach is that Mr. K there was no such thing as an untalented kid, just a kid who didn't work hard enough. And, of course, if you are teaching music with that perspective, then it's little wonder why Mr. Kopczynski brought such passion and relentless drive to the task. If this was about, in a sense, willing students of limited gifts to do well, there was no other way to do it.
That's right. And he believed in, you know, it was discipline and repetition and practice. My early music books are marked all over with his handwriting in giant block letters that just say, again, 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 which I swear was probably his favorite word, most used word in the English language was again. But it worked, and it was this concept that you can do better. And you know what it translates into? And I think at the end of the day, this is one of the reasons why he was so successful and why Strings Attached is resonating with people, is because as harsh as he was, what it really boiled down to was optimism. He had boundless optimism, in boundless faith in his students' ability to do better. And it gave us all faith and confidence in our ability to do better. So when I started the viola with him, even though I'd flamed out on the piano and had no, you know, there was no sense I had any talent, I was so determined, and he put no limits on what I could do. It was always, he always had an expectation that I could do better, and I always wanted to do better. And his highest compliment, because he didn't compliment this, his highest compliment would be not bad. And if you got a not bad, you were dancing down the street, and you'd go home, and you'd practice twice as hard. And what it did is it gave us all confidence in ourselves, and that kind of quality of perseverance and self-motivation. All these things that you hear people today saying, you know, kids don't have enough self-motivation because they're guided and told every, you know, and you have the trophies for everyone mentality, so people don't learn how to kind of fail and pick themselves back up again. And those are all qualities that Mr. K taught us, that whether you pursued music or whether you went into some other field, those are the skills you need in life to succeed.
Hmm. Let's give our listeners just a quick little snapshot view of just how scary Mr. K was in rehearsal. I'm thinking, for instance, of one thing that I believe it's you describing, when your orchestra was contending with a fiendishly difficult piece, or it was fiendishly difficult for these young musicians, Brahms's Academic Festival Overture. And you describe what Mr. K did when he was hearing some kind of wrong note somewhere in the violin section. Explain to our listeners what Mr. K would do in a situation like that.
So if Mr. K heard one wrong note, literally, he would stop the whole orchestra and he would scream, you know, he'd say, "Who is deaf in first violin?" Or sometimes he would say, "Who is idiot who play wrong note?" And it's funny now, but, you know, it was slightly terrifying. But he was so hard on us, and he just made us rehearse again and again and again. And certainly that some of his methods you couldn't get away with, nor would you want to today, in today's world. But many of his methods are the research is showing actually he was right. Like a lot of things that we backed away from, because a lot of his methods are things that we kind of think fly in the face of everything we know about education. But in fact, the new research is showing that he was right. Things like repetition and rote, and things like allowing us to fail and pick ourselves back up again, and discipline and being strict. I mean, all of these things the research is now showing are actually the mark of effective teachers. And also, they also help the self-esteem and confidence of students, which is sort of counterintuitive.
Sure.
It builds their confidence.
We should say, too, that for as frightening as Mr. K was, in just what you described, there is also some humor in there. I mean, and the book is just full of these wonderful lines that he would throw out about, you know, when he would hear something that caused him dismay. I mean, he wouldn't just say that was bad or that was flat or you're rushing. I mean, he would find some intriguing picture, string together some interesting words, maybe even playing off the fact that English was his second language, to make the point in a way that, you know, even while it was on its surface harsh, there was something a little funny about it, which also probably helped it penetrate. Can you just give our listeners a sense of what I'm talking about there?
Sure. I mean, you know, he would say, he had these very funny sayings, you know, cellos sound like hippopotamus rising from mud in the river. You know, he had these ridiculous things. He had a very funny sense of humor, and he also had a huge heart, which there's a lot of humor in the book, but there's also so much heart. I mean, he would do things. In addition, you know, he was tough on us, but he had such love for the students and such passion for education. So he would do things for us, like, you know, he had us perform all the time, but he would take us to nursing homes and to hospitals to play for the patients, and it really instilled a sense of public service in his students that I think lasted a lifetime. And I also think a lot of it came from his own past. I mean, he, as we mentioned, had this incredibly difficult private life that included a childhood that he never, ever spoke about in Ukraine. And we did a massive amount of research, actually, to find out about his childhood, which it turns out was spent fleeing. I mean, he was born right before World War II, and he spent his entire childhood amid bloodshed and destruction in Ukraine, fleeing from the Russians and the Nazis and the Poles in refugee camps. He was starved. He was, his entire childhood was a struggle, not just, you know, to survive and also to finish the school year. It was so hard for him to get an education that when he finally came here to the United States, he was already 19 years old. He spoke no English. He'd never had even a music lesson at that point. He loved music, but there was never an opportunity for him to learn music. And so he was so grateful, I think, to be in the United States and have the opportunities he had to learn English, to get educated, to learn music, and then to turn around and teach it to others, that I think that passion just overflowed. He had such gratitude for his life, despite all of its hardships, that just infected all of us. I mean, it really carried over to all of his students.
In spectacular fashion. And I love all the moments in the book when you share moments about sort of his soft, tender side. For instance, an experience where he brought maybe your quartet or some of the young players for the first time to play in a nursing home. and gently explaining to you how some of these older people might want to reach out and actually physically touch you, and that they're not around children often, it would mean so much to them. And I just love that window into the tender corners of his soul, of this guy that was otherwise in so many ways scary to you. I want to finish with a question that has really been on my mind as I have read your wonderful book. I happen to be a teacher of music. I'm in my real life, the rest of the day, I'm a professor of music, a voice teacher, actually. And when I look at the list of sort of principles that guided Mr. K, things like strict is better than nice makes me realize that I'm actually a really nice guy and not all that strict, and that in so many respects I am poles apart from Mr. K in the way that I teach music. And I'm really struggling with that. And I don't want to make this about me, but I think a lot of music teachers would read this book and react the same way, and particularly public school teachers at this time when the arts are kind of under fire and many of them are treading lightly. There's probably part of them that want to be more like Mr. K. Do you think it's that this is the kind of music teacher he needed to be because this is who he was? Or do you feel like all of us who teach music should be more like Mr. K, even if that's not really who we are when we just sort of roll out of bed and our natural selves? Would you want music teachers, no matter who we are, to sort of reach deep into ourselves and find our inner Mr. K as we're working with our students? I wonder if you've thought much about that.
We actually, Melanie and I thought a lot about this, and I think where we come down is that clearly there's no one size fits all for teaching. And Mr. K's younger daughter, Stephanie, became a teacher who embraced so many of his methods, but she was also incredibly kind, and she was not a yeller at her students. But I think that the bottom line really is, you know, the subtitle of the book, it's Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. And I think that great expectations, that to me is the bottom line. The unifying factor for all of these great teachers is that they inspire and that they expect a lot of their students in the same way Mr. K expected a lot of us, and it showed he had his very strict methods. But I think that great teachers have that belief in their students and the passion for their subject, and those are the things that give the student the confidence they need to succeed, the tools they need to succeed. And it really is, at the end of the day, it's optimism, it's faith in your students' ability. And I don't think you need to be tough necessarily to convey that, but I do think that it does have to do with having high standards and having the belief that your student can meet them.
Very well put. It's a terrific book and a stupendous story. Again, the book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And the book, by the way, is also full of wonderful and sometimes very poignant photographs that also bring this story to life. And Joanne Lipman, a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you, and congratulations on an absolutely terrific book.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we step into the mind of a brilliant engineer and find out what engineering is all about and what engineers do, and specifically how engineers tend to view the world. Andrew Burrows is the author of Everyday Engineering, How Engineers See. On Wednesday, I'll speak with political science professor Dr. Gerald Mast from Carthage. We'll be talking about, of course, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. On Thursday, a brilliant novelist, Roisin Meany, and her book called Semi-Sweet, a novel of love and cupcakes. And on Friday, postponed from last week, Mary Roach, the author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and is also available as a podcast through Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. Be sure that you look for the program under its title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And if you subscribe, you can enjoy a different morning show interview 7 days.